This is Driven by Data, the podcast.
Welcome back to another season of Driven by Data, the podcast. Powered by Orbition Group and hosted by me, Kyle Winterbottom. We are delighted to bring you season four of Driven by Data, the podcast, and our aim remains exactly the same: to bring you some of the most respected and recognized thought leadership figures from the world of data analytics to share their knowledge, ideas, use cases, and insights across how they've tackled some of the industry's most trending topics and challenges. All that's left to say is sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode. Welcome to Driven by Data, the podcast, season four. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Anthony Cosgrove, who is the co-founder of Harbour. So, Anthony, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's all right. It's been a long time coming. I know we probably spoke, it feels like years ago. It wasn't years ago. It's probably about 8-9 months ago. And then, we've changed the recording date several times for illness and kids and all, whatever else, sports day or something, no doubt. But we're here now. That's all that matters. So
here we are. Yeah, we are ready to go.
So where we always start, Anthony, is by asking our guests to give themselves a brief introduction into their background and, I guess, journey to date up until this point in time, if you would.
Yeah, sure. So I know people usually just kind of start with a little bit of the CV, but I'm just going to go a bit earlier and just talk about academics for a second, because it kind of bleeds into the story and probably what we'll cover. So my academic background was international relations and politics. So like absolutely nothing to do with computers or data or kind of science or even kind of STEM. And then I kind of fell into data. So I kind of pursued that path and kind of all roads end up leading to data. And I think that's probably quite common of a lot of people. My network is probably a bit biased and leans more towards data because I work in the space. But I just know so many people with so many different backgrounds and so many different jobs, all of whom have sort of migrated towards data or found themselves in the data world and, you know, data really affecting their jobs on a day-to-day basis. And I'm kind of no exception to that. So I kind of went from there. I moved into government and I was an analyst there for about 5-6 years, which was amazing. And I still kind of consider myself to be an analyst by trade. You know, my degree plus that was sort of honing those analytical skills. And then I kind of bounced out of there and went to HSBC. And when I joined HSBC, it was just enormous. It was 330,000 employees in over 90 countries. I think there were like 7 group languages. So, you know, from a sort of a UK government department to that was like a real change. And what I started doing there was information security work. So reporting to a lady who would now be called a chief information security officer, but that wasn't really a title back then. You know, I'm quite old. So I spent about 3 years doing that. Then Bernie Madoff happened and HSBC had acquired a company called Bank of Bermuda, and Bank of Bermuda were the administrator for Bernie Madoff's fund. So there's quite a lot of exposure there. And the CEO at the time of the global banking and markets sort of kind of investment banking part of HSBC, it's a guy called Stuart Gulliver. And he kind of noted that, you know, we had a huge amount of controls around fraud risk and fraud management in the retail bank, but in the investment bank, there really none. And kind of, we were basically tasked to start looking at that and trying to see if we could identify lead risk indicators around wholesale banking fraud. And that was a really interesting challenge because you had this these sort of events that happen. And unlike retail fraud, where it's happening every minute of every day and there's lots of patterns and like kind of big data crunching, what you have there is it happening kind of infrequently. But when it happens, it's huge and the losses are enormous. So So it's kind of a black swan event. And the ones that have happened, there's usually then some regulations, some changes, and they don't happen the same way again. So you're constantly trying to work out, well, how could it happen at some point in the future? How do we find indicators that suggest that? So we ended up building a data platform. And that's kind of where I fell into data, as I mentioned earlier. We brought scores of sources into one place, internal sources, external data sources that we bought or were acquired. We then built kind of network graphs. So we resolved all of the entities. So, you know, what is, pick a company, BP. You know, BP is hundreds of legal entities. It's hundreds of executive and non-executive directors. It's potentially lots of different brands. You know, how do you turn that into a coherent thing that you can see and understand and analyze? So we used kind of network analytics and entity resolution to do that. And then we did a load of algorithmic scoring, and I built a team who effectively engaged with that platform and then spoke to the relationship managers for those various accounts, you know, and had really good productive conversations around risk identification and risk management, which was cool. And then HSBC got, you know, like a $2 billion fine for failings around money laundering. And at that point, Stuart Gulliver, who had sort of pioneered this project, had become the CEO of the group. And from his perspective, it was completely and utterly unacceptable that HSBC had kind of fallen into kind of that position. And he put a huge amount of kind of weight and investment behind making sure HSBC could identify quite complex money laundering and other types of financial crimes, quite significantly beyond the minimum that was required within the regulation to ensure that we didn't have that kind of exposure any longer. So we kind of took what we had done and we sort of morphed it a little bit and we changed it. And we ended up building a second data platform. This time it was some newfangled technology, which now is like super old school, which was like on-prem Hadoop clusters. And we were like one of the first implementations within, you know, a large financial services environment. So, you know, essentially a data lake. And we pumped the data in there. We homogenized it, standardized it, created these tables that were easy to query. And we created this sort of single view of customers and their transactions in order to be able to identify like nefarious activity. So quite a lot of pattern matching and that kind of thing. And that was like quite a big success, but there were a bunch of challenges. And yeah, we'll probably touch on that a bit later. And effectively those challenges and the frustrations I had around like, how do I get more value out of this work that we've done? And finding that getting more value out of the work I'd done was really quite hard. And I'd built kind of like a one trick pony. Like it did a hell of a trick, but it really only did one. That really informed kind of my next step, which was to kind of move out of HSBC, start my own company called Harbor. And Harbor's been running for about 7 years now. And Harbor is a data platform that seeks to solve a lot of the problems that I encountered there. So that's sort of the journey overall.
Nice. So I don't know if anybody has ever surmised it this way, Anthony, but obviously in my line of work, I do a lot of speaking to people about obviously their careers. And obviously what Bernie Madoff did was absolutely despicable, but in a way he was partly responsible for your success.
Now, right? In some weird way, you could certainly put it like that. Yeah.
Interesting. No, I'm only joking. Right. Before, tell us a little bit then about Harbor, and then what I always love to do with people that have started companies is to understand what the catalyst was. And you kind of started to allude to it there, that, you know, that there were things that you were frustrated by that you probably felt you could do better. But just give us the high level. Who is Harbor? What do you do? What, you know, who do you work with? What types of problems are you trying to solve? All that type of good stuff.
Sure. So if I give you the sort of the facts and figures, you know, it's about data. So why don't we start there? So we're almost 7 years old. In 8 days, not that I'm counting, we'll be 7 years old. It's a VC-backed kind of tech startup. We're headquartered in London. We've raised sort of $50 million sort of over the course of that period of time. And the product itself is a platform as a service. So we kind of create one for each individual customer, which is a bit of feedback we got quite early in our journey, that people kind of wanted their own one. They didn't want a sort of communal SaaS version of what we had built. And effectively, our customers use that for like at a top level, three kind of use cases. So the first is that they use it for data commerce. So they are selling data, they're selling access to models, they might be selling data-related services. And effectively, their Harbor platform becomes the digital front end for their data business. It's where they interact with their customers and deliver nice self-service workflows in a really modern, kind of intuitive user environment, and where they're also able to collaborate directly with those customers in order to drive and accelerate outcomes. I can talk a bit more about that if that's of interest. The second is using the platform to support very tightly governed external data sharing. So again, working with organizations outside of your own legal entity, your own corporate group, and wrapping enough governance around data, which you can do as an asset or you can manage as a data product. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a minute. And effectively taking that data to an external audience in a way that they can find it, understand what it's useful for, gain access to it via a subscription, and then have the platform really both enable some user journeys so that they can get value from that data, but also to enable user journeys that give the producer a lot more control and a lot more governance over how that data is used. Because that interaction between somebody who produces or owns the data and somebody who's consuming it, it's a balancing act, right? It's a trade-off.
Yep.
So I might have some data that I'm happy to give to you. I might have some data that I'm happy for you to see, but I don't want to give it to you. You know, if you need it, we might not be able to interact because I'm not comfortable with that. But there might be some technology in the middle that makes me comfortable, but still allows you to get value. So the platform does that for the external data sharing. And then what we're seeing now, like increasingly, which is been really interesting, and we'll talk about data products, we'll talk about data mesh, we'll talk about data product management, but what we're seeing now is the platform being used as an enterprise data marketplace, and this is particularly in the larger corporates, where those internal environments, you know, not dissimilar to HSBC, are lots of legal entities, lots of jurisdictions, lots of different storage layers of data that have accrued over many years, and their data users, who used to be a small set of technical users with computer science or kind of STEM types of backgrounds, and are now almost everybody in their company, are kind of unable to interact with the data. Like they struggle to find it. If they find it, they struggle to access it. If they access it, they struggle to use it. If they use it, they struggle with sharing it and reusing it, or moving it around or getting it to where it needs to be, or doing that on an ongoing basis. So really, a lot of that kind of enterprise data marketplace is actually about data enablement, data democratization. And that's really coming through really, really strong now. And a lot of what we're focused on now is supporting that use case as well as the others.
Nice. Interesting. I guess just thinking out loud and purely curiosity, but when you started the business, were those problems, were the use cases that you're now seeing this being used for, were they the problems that you were trying to address, or is that being a kind of
even? Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've been there, right? You kind of start with a hypothesis, and then you find out just how wrong you are as you go through that journey. And you hope that sometimes you're like right enough that you've got something that's kind of on point. You know, that journey from an idea to actually having a product that fits with the market and delivers value, you know, in a economic way is a challenging journey and a fun journey sometimes and a awful journey at other points. So when we started, you know, the kernel of the idea behind Harbor came from me being an analyst, me having a lot of empathy for less technical users, and then experiencing what happens when you follow the playbook for data, which for decades has been take the data out of the source systems, put it in some aggregation, warehouse, lakehouse, lake, whatever that happens to be, run SQL against it, and increasingly now other languages, Python, R, whatever it happens to be, and then you're good. And I did that. and I wasn't good. It wasn't good. What we had done was we had effectively manufactured the data. So we'd done all of that work. And I still think that work needed to happen. Like, I think you could argue that you might have been able to do something slightly different. I'm not sure that would have been economical. I'm not sure it would have been technically feasible at the time. But yeah, so anyway, so we did that and we'd manufactured this data. And the data we had manufactured wasn't like perfect by any means. You know, some of our analysts were actually like, I don't like the way you've manufactured this data. Like, you've made it too clean, or the way you kind of resolved those parts are like, they don't work for me. And you've taken some signal as well as the noise, and that's unhelpful. So we had kind of a bit of that, which is fair and a risk, and you have to balance it. But what was basically missing was the consumer journey. And the consumer journey at that point was like, well, just connect a tool to your storage layer, right? And you're good. And people use that tool and you're away. But what we found was there was this sort of intermediate layer of like, well, what data is exposed to the tool? And if I need to expose data to lots of different tools, how does that work? And where does that happen? And you very sort of quickly kind of see that there's this bit missing, which is, okay, I've done my data manufacturing, I'm getting something out that's an asset, it's good. But then that gap between I've got an asset and somebody's getting value from it is actually quite large. And just throwing a tool at it doesn't really work. That doesn't give you any recyclability. It doesn't give you any scalability. There's no self-service. There's a lack of collaboration. And you also kind of lack empathy between the people that are actually creating those data assets and the people that are ultimately using them, which is where the value is realized. So what we wanted to do with Harbor was to really go, okay, let's fill that gap. Let's fill that gap. And what would that look like? And it was interesting because we kind of started with the consumer experience. We're like, as an analyst, what would I love? Like, what would I like to log into in the morning and be faced with that would make my job easier? And what we ended up with was something that looks and functions a lot like a data marketplace. So a range of data products, you know, very intuitive interface, you know, very easy. You don't have to be technically skilled to engage with it. You see the data, it's got a nice description, it has a visual identity, it's got terms and conditions associated with it. It has restrictions around how it can be used. They're enforced by the platform. And then there are user journeys. And we started with two fairly basic user journeys. So one was a sandbox. So I can now share data with you, but you can't take it away. So that's good. So for me as a producer, I can probably share more because I have that control. But the consumer can still be enabled to get value. And then the second one was, I'm going to allow you to take it away. And the platform's going to support you in creating a no-code data pipeline to move that to where you need it to be. So they were kind of like the first two patterns that we started with. We've now got about 9 different patterns around how somebody would consume, use, and distribute the data once they've found it and subscribed to it. And what we didn't really think too much about, because it was kind of intuitive, was data products and data as a product. Like, we didn't sit down trying to define it. We were like, well, what is a data product? And like, you know, comparing and contrasting different methodologies for that. It was just intuitive. It was like, well, any digital experience I have where I go to find something and gain access to it, it's productized, and they're just endless examples of that. So let's not sweat it too much. Let's just create the things and be quite market led in what we include or don't include. And then I think we also sort of didn't think too much about kind of where the data was. You know, we started with moving the data into the storage layer of the platform. You know, what we do now is we have this flexible data management layer. The data can be anywhere. Like, we don't care, and you shouldn't care. And do you know who really doesn't care? Your user. Your user really doesn't care where it is unless they need it to be local to them and they have to move it, in which case they want it in their environment. But where it comes from, they still don't care, right? What they're interested in, does this satisfy my use case? That's broadly it. Like, we're all kind of pretty selfish. We want to do what we need to do for our day-to-day jobs. So that's kind of where we started. And then it's been interesting the way that's unfolded over the last 7 years, where data mesh has come to the fore, which is very, very similar with some meaningful differences around kind of what we do and what the platform enables. Data product management and data products have really come to the fore in a way that they just weren't when we started. And then this concept of like a data marketplace and data democratization and enablement, that's also kind of come through. So it's been interesting to watch all of this stuff unfold while we've been sort of on that kind of journey over the last 7 years.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. Obviously, you touched upon the kind of data products management piece. So I think let's try and tackle that while we're talking about it. Obviously, that seems in of itself to have been a movement, right? And I mean, I remember hosting some of our own events probably close to 2 years ago now, right, where you had chief data officers sat in a room arguing between the definition of data as a product versus data products. So I want to put you on the spot here, Anthony, and A, ask you how you define it, but B, ask how those definitions and how that movement and journey in of itself has maybe impacted what you do at Harbour, right, and how you think about helping organizations to use data more effectively.
Yeah, so where to begin? So I think when I was building certainly the second data platform in HSBC, you know, we were a sort of internal product management function. So we spent a lot of time engaging and interacting with our users who were analysts. So there were like 500-600 kind of financial crime analysts who were just looking for complex financial crime. So we engaged really closely with them, built really strong empathy with what they needed, and then initially tried to sort of contort this sort of very large aggregate all your data program to their needs. In parallel, we had some more dynamic kind of iterative prototype type of stuff that was going on, where we helped them with their day-to-day job without a big data transformation program, which, like, with hindsight, I kind of wish we had started there and maybe finished there, because I think that was tremendously helpful, and it was a more economical way of supporting them in their roles, and was quite transformative for them. And you know, that was like a grassroots thing by a couple of super innovative developers working kind of hand in glove with some of those analysts, like literally sitting next to them and working out what they needed and just trying to find ways to help them kind of go faster or better. And scale what they were doing, just save a lot of time. And they were pretty successful in doing that. But that idea that when you're serving data to someone, wherever you are in that chain, right, whether you're building and deploying a data platform, whether you're somebody that's taking source systems and turning them into something that's a bit more standardized and a bit more dependable, you know, hopefully the quality is maybe a bit better. The idea that can be done in the absence of product management just feels wrong. And I've seen a lot of data project management that just through a lack of really deep understanding and empathy for the use cases and the user's needs has just gone sideways, and like really badly sideways. Like, you can kind of see it in some of the metrics, like, well, how many sources have we like added to the thing? It's like, well, who cares? Like, how much value have you got out of the back of the thing? Like, that's really what's important. So that kind of felt very intuitive. And like I said, we didn't think hard about it. We just sort of were like, well, that's sort of obviously like how you would want to do this when you're thinking about the consumer and a consumer experience. I think the other part is sort of when you think about product for, I don't know, like since the beginning of capitalism, maybe earlier, like products have been the mechanism that we've used to optimize value. Why would data be any different? And I've still never heard anyone make a compelling case that data is so profoundly different it A, shouldn't be subject to product management or shouldn't be part of products. It shouldn't be productized. I've also not heard anything profoundly like persuasive that data is so nuanced and so context specific that it's its whole own discipline and its own special type of product management. I think there is nuance, definitely. I think there is subject matter expertise. I think there's wisdom and knowledge and experience that's super important if you're going to be managing a data product. But it's probably the same if you're managing a car, right? And my product's a car, or my product is a, you know, Heinz ketchup or something. Like, you know, you are going to need to understand the nuance of what you're dealing with, the raw materials, the consumers, the market, the competitors, the mechanisms for manufacturing something, the mechanisms for distributing something and taking it to market. So I think that's specific, but product management and applying product management to data, A, it's a bit of a no-brainer in my mind, and B, it's sort of not profoundly different from any type of product management. I find some of the debates interesting. Like, I've had a go at coming up with a definition of a data product, and there's n number of data product, data as a product definitions, and all this kind of stuff. And I think this is sort of academically interesting for people within data. But as soon as you come out of that like little bubble and you start interacting with, you know, the broad range of people that need to use and interact with data on a day-to-day basis, but aren't necessarily data practitioners or data specialists, you know, they're marketers or salespeople or risk managers or, you know, whatever they are, they don't really care. They're like, do you have what I need or not? Help me understand that. And if you do have it, like, how do I get access to it and use it to get the value that I'm looking for? So that's, you know, maybe a, you know, hopefully a pragmatic, maybe a slightly dismissive sort of riff on data product management. But I think it's great that we're seeing data product managers turn up. Awesome. I talk to a lot of them and I think they're doing amazing work, and it's been way too long the data has been existing without having real product manager rigor applied to it. So I think that's fantastic. I think as a group, they're going to get a lot more kind of service than they've previously had. So there'll be some unique tools and various things to help them. And then the other bit that I do find interesting in this whole debate. So when we started and initially went to market, our first customers were organizations that were already selling data-related services, access to models, access to what would be called a data app now, but back then was just solutions. They have product managers. They've always had product managers for as long as those businesses have existed, and they are data product managers. And some of them don't call themselves data product managers. Most of them call themselves product managers. And they are managing data as a product and have been for decades. And they're managing it as a product in a commercial setting. So actually selling it, going to market, you know, doing the marketing, doing the sales, doing the post-sales fulfillment, looking at the operations around manufacturing, distribution, optimizing those. So that kind of discipline has actually existed for a really long time, and you can see it if you know where to look.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when you talk about, you know, monetizing data in the true sense of productizing it and selling it, I think, you know, that makes a lot of sense. I think what I found fascinating was, if I think about in my world, what I see loads of is recruitment's always a good barometer of marketplaces, right? And what you tend to find, that you start to see certain titles pop up and some stick and some don't. And you see how some organizations are using that title in one way versus another organization that's using the same title, but in a completely different way. And that happens in our industry all the time, right? I mean, even chief data officer roles are subject to absolute context, right?
Data science. I mean, that was another one that popped up, right?
100%, right? You know, I mean, even engineering, right? You can have four companies that all call somebody in a role a data engineer, and they're doing four different roles, right? And then the vice versa might be true. However, what I found fascinating there, what you said, and that kind of supports, I guess, a lot of what I'm seeing, is you have what companies are calling data products managers, and they're all, almost now acting as the bridge between data and the technical teams and the users, that then starts to get you into this conversation around usage and adoption and all of that type of good stuff. Yeah. But as you said, these people, the people using it, they don't care. Like, they don't care whether you call it a product or not. But I do wonder, what we've seem to find is that that's definitely helped organizations drive better usage and adoption, because maybe the way we are just have been, you know, taught, and the rest of the world works, is that you have a product, you use a product. So by, you know, talking in product language, like, we have this product that helps you to do X as a use case. Now, data is underpinned in that, but they don't need to know that, right? But that seems to be helping organizations. And when you actually look at it like that, you think, well, how much product management as a discipline is going into that, because sometimes it can be, hey, I've got this dashboard, right? And, you know, use this dashboard because it's a product. And they'll go, okay, cool. Yeah, we've got this new data product that's a dashboard that we'll use because it's a product. And me and you were sat here thinking, well, is that a product? That's a bit loosely defined, but whatever, we'll go with it, right? So I think that's fascinating, because I think you're right. People, the users don't actually care all that much like what we call it. It's just about getting to the outcome, right? Which I think we're definitely seeing in how businesses are almost using the title to help them do what they need to do and to help their business be better at what they're trying to achieve fundamentally.
Yeah, and look, I mean, like, you know, some of the kind of insular jargon that, you know, as data people, we are brilliant at creating. I mean, we are just excellent at creating jargon and arguing over definitions. I think it just goes with the territory, right? You know, we like specificity. We like to organize things. We like things structured and logical, and the same applies to the language. But I think, you know, the stuff that we create ourselves, data product, data as a product, you know, of questionable use, particularly outside of that kind of community. But to your point, like, just using the word product, helpful. Using the phrase target addressable market, helpful. Personas, helpful. Use cases, helpful. Scalability, helpful. ROI, helpful. Like, this is all really helpful stuff, and this is classic product management. You know, whether you're managing a piece of software, or some data, or you know, a car, you know, whatever that happens to be, they're all the things you do need to be thinking about and taking into consideration. And that coming into data, amazing, like amazing, because I think for so long, what you had was a huge amount of investment in a small subset of very technical users, primarily manufacturing data, with the best will in the world. Then there was like some project management around that. But that bit at the end, which is the bit that has to happen of taking it to market, like whether that's, you know, five people in your analytics team or 10,000 financial services organizations that you service on a regular basis and sell data to or sell services to, it doesn't matter, right? That bit is crucial and was missing. And that's really the gap that I kind of saw at HSBC as I was sort of manufacturing stuff and we kind of got something out. But because that bit was missing, we just ended up in this really kind of monolithic black box sort of environment where it was like impenetrable and people didn't understand what was in there, and they didn't really understand how to change what was there or customize it or make it more relevant to their use case. And it was all kind of hidden away with like technical users can access and do stuff to it, but the business users can't, and lack of like user experience around getting value from it, like all of the problems that we've just been discussing. And crucially for us, there wasn't any technology that really spoke to that at the time. It just wasn't a thing. And I remember going around, you know, like startup stories. I remember going around at the start and talking to people and like, yeah, so we're like, you know, we'll get the data and we'll put it into, you know, sort of like imagine Amazon, but like, or eBay, but it's data. And people are like, don't know what you're talking about. Like, you just made this up. And I'm like, well, yeah, I kind of have just made it up. But like, do you not think that'd be amazing? And they're like, I don't think it's a thing. And, you know, and that's kind of where we were, because everybody was in that mindset of like lakes, warehouses. Oh, now we're moving to the cloud. You know, oh, there's this thing called like data science and, you know, people are now writing models and, you know, and that's kind of where everybody was. And still nobody was really thinking about the end user and the end consumer. And nobody was really appreciating that those end users and end consumers weren't technical. Like the bulk of them increasingly were non-technical, who just bumped into data as part of their career. And now were having to sort of engage with this thing that they didn't necessarily understand. You know, they weren't necessarily able to code against. You know, that wasn't really part and parcel of what they had ever done or signed up to do when they chose to do that role.
Yeah. Absolutely. Makes perfect sense. So I guess from those early days then and those conversations, and obviously you spoke to this earlier when you kind of said, here's kind of loosely what we thought was going to be, you know, the product. I guess what are the main challenges that you see, you know, chief data officers or anyone leading a data analytics function in terms of, you know, that data asset that they have to manage? What are the kind of, you know, main challenges you see them facing?
Yeah. So if I think about the chief data officer in particular, and while I was at HSBC, we kind of got a chief data officer, like the last year and a bit, like a chief data officer turned up. And it was kind of interesting. So I'm in this sort of slightly like product-y type role, right, where I've got this user base of analysts and I'm trying to get data to them and I'm managing systems because that's kind of what you were doing back then, as opposed to the data itself. And then we sort of kind of got into the data at the latter stages. And the chief data officer was really focused on compliance and governance, right? Like, what have we got? Where is it? Which stuff is going to kind of bite us in the ass? Like, GDPR is coming along. Like, does anyone know what we're doing? Like, with PII and consents, like, where is all that stuff? So it kind of started there. And that was really kind of almost like managing a liability or like managing a risk. And that was fine. Like, I think kind of where we were at that point in time, that needed to be done. You know, I remember looking around and just thinking like the whole data estate was just a mess. Like, it was just stuff that had just been built over so many decades, with people executing projects, implementing systems, you know, gaining some data, moving some data somewhere else. And it was just this completely like, just this like swamp of like this mad ecosystem that you just couldn't really see or navigate or understand. So like taking the stuff out and standardizing it and having it in one place was like a really logical thing to do to that, because you could govern it and manage it. And the chief data officer came in and was like, well, I've got to manage and govern the whole thing. And that's really complicated. And it is a job that needed to be done. And I think now, and you'll know this better than me, but it feels like the chief data officer has kind of gone through that evolution and it's kind of moving away from risk management or like avoiding exposure to a liability. And it's now about value. Right? How do we optimize value? We spent a lot of money. We spent a lot of time. You know, we continue to invest in things. You know, we've done these big, like multi-year, multi-million-dollar transformation programs. We've moved to the cloud. We've standardized something. Like, where's the value? Like, where is it now? And I think that is the objective for chief data officers and increasingly the objective for chief data officers. And when I look at that and I think about what are the challenges, I think the challenges sort of boil down to kind of one core theme, which is around complexity. And that complexity is born from the level of diversity that they have to deal with. So that diversity is, you know, users. Let's take that as an example. I've got a data scientist with a PhD in astrophysics who can write, you know, multiple coding languages and is super happy with the command line. And then over here, I've got a senior executive who doesn't do any of that stuff at all. And they kind of want a good insight that they can use reliably to take probably a really meaningful business decision. And then you've got this whole spectrum in between of like data analyst, kind of business analyst, you know, analyst, like whatever it happens to be. And people just in random roles where a bit of data comes in and that kind of informs the decision somewhere or somehow. So you've got a very, very diverse user base. And I think for most organizations of any meaningful size, that's a very diverse user base. You then have a lot of diverse data. So data's baked into systems, data coming in as feeds, data being distributed and redistributed around the organization, loads of different formats, loads of different schemas, loads of different structures, varying levels of quality. Like, that's super diverse, really complicated. Catalog helps to give you some visibility. It doesn't change the picture. You've then got kind of the systems themselves, which is kind of tied to the data, but also independent. And what you typically see is kind of standardization after standardization after standardization, all of which are kind of half baked or half finished. And then a new technology came along or a strategy was changed. And then, you know, started standardizing on something else. And that has literally been what's happened again and again and again and again over about 40 or 50 years. And you're left with this incredible legacy of like, oh, we still have a bit of, you know, DB2. And we're also happen to be on Databricks and Snowflake and, you know, everything in between. And, you know, tomorrow we'll be on something else, which is the next new thing. So you've got all of that complexity there. And then the real wild card, which makes that like exponentially more challenging to get value out of, is boundaries. So you've got kind of team boundaries, you've got departmental boundaries, you've got legal entity boundaries, and then you've got the boundaries around a corporate group. So customers, suppliers, partners, you know, and their mosaic of boundaries. And to get value from data, you often have to cross a boundary, right? And how does that work, right? Because you have to manage risk. You also have to enable the value or it's pointless. And doing that is quite tricky. Doing that on top of diverse systems, diverse data for diverse users is super hard. And I think for chief data officers, they've kind of got two approaches to that. And they're not mutually exclusive. If I was in a CDO role today, I'd be trying to do both to some degree. Like the first is what we've been doing since the beginning, just remove that diversity, like standardize it in a system, create a common schema, common structure, common format. Tell all the business users they have to learn SQL. You know, decide that, you know, you're going to treat all of these people in this particular way and all of those people in that particular way. I'm going to create some rules around data sharing and they're very standardized and they're codified and that's all good. And that's all about like just getting rid of some of that complexity. So you actually have something you can actually engage with. The bit that I think people have done less of, but is also really, really important and leans into the product management bit that we were mentioning earlier, is just managing that diversity. So you can say everybody should learn SQL, and if they can't learn SQL, then that's tough. But if 90% of your target addressable market doesn't write SQL, like as a product manager, you're going to look for an alternative. What can I deliver to them that doesn't require them using SQL or writing SQL? Is it a visualization? Is it a data app? Is it a slider? Is it, you know, some sort of kind of interactive like chat? Like, what is it? Like a natural language query? So I think that has been interesting for us to watch, because a lot of what we do in the platform is, because it's consumer orientated, it's about flexibility. And it's about how can you adapt your data to different users and provide them with different user experiences without having to bring all your data into one place, without having to create numerous copies of that data, and without having to sort of really contort the user journeys or contort the tooling to, you know, specific use cases or specific users. So really that's all about flexibility, and how do you manage diversity at scale, which is collaboration, self-service, like a bunch of other principles, asynchronous working, as opposed to just how can I standardize and homogenize everything just to get rid of that pesky complexity stuff, which is really annoying me. And I think broadly for us, and this is a rule of thumb, it's probably not perfect, but if you're manufacturing data, I think it broadly makes sense to try and standardize and homogenize. And you see that in the manufacturing of any type of product, right? They just try and get everything as standardized, reliable as possible. And then when you're at that bit of like going to the consumer, you want choice and you want flexibility and you want to have this sort of broad kind of aperture in terms of what you can service, who you can service, where you service them, how you service them, and what their needs are.
Mm. That's really interesting. I guess of the organizations that you're supporting and working with then, are there any, or I should say, what do you think the most common reason is that your customers use your technology for?
Yeah, so I think it's I think the flexibility part is really important, because often, I mean, particularly if you've got like a product manager in the mix, which usually there is, you know, or a chief data officer that really understands that they're never gonna get everybody to write SQL, they're never gonna get all of their data into one system. If they did get all their data into one system, it wouldn't service all the use cases. So, you know, who understand that is the nature of the challenge, they put a premium on flexibility. So can a data scientist use this? Can a data analyst use this? Could I invite a business executive? Could I invite a board member to this? Like, will that work? Is it intuitive enough? Can the user journeys be adapted and adjusted to service their needs so that they don't just log in and just immediately log out and get somebody else to log in for them? So I think that's really important. I think the way that we manage the data has been really interesting. So we started, as I said, where you bring data into the platform, and we still see a load of use cases for that. Like, you can like drag and drop a spreadsheet and turn it into an asset in the platform. You can then productize it, which means packaging, permissioning, and placing it somewhere it can be discovered. And that's really simple and easy and intuitive and great. Like, just easy. But you could just leave the data where it is at source, create a connector, and then effectively connect to that data and support user experiences around it without moving it, without creating another copy, without having to keep those copies in sync. So I think that that flexibility component is probably the main thrust. Like if you really kind of claw it back, that's probably the main motivation for using us, and just understanding that if you're going to democratize it, you know, democracy equals diversity and choice. And that means you need something very, very flexible that can meet people where they are.
Yeah, 100%. And that makes sense, obviously, as you talked about earlier, you know, the whole notion of democratization has kind of, you know, come out of the woodwork over the last several years and for very obvious reasons. But I think, you know, it's been no secret that a lot of data analytics journeys have started, you know, often from, I don't know, hype, fear of missing out, something like that, right? And you get this, well, we're going to need a platform to try and pull everything together, so let's build it. And there's never been any thought about, okay, well, once we've got it there, how do we use it? You know, the thing that you mentioned there about flexibility of, we're going to, you know, as you said, you got a PhD data scientist looking at the same data sets as executive, right? You know, so then it's kind of like you've got such ends of a spectrum, and that's not often thought about until it's too late. And a lot of the work goes into getting to that point, and then people are using it, and then you're like, oh, I spent all this money, all this time, no one wants it.
Yeah.
Time. Then you get into the whole, there is no value, you know, and it just unravels very quickly from that point. So that makes
sense. And that example I shared earlier, where we had these two super innovative developers just took it, like, they took to it the weekend, right? They started the weekend, they understood what the analysts needed. They built a prototype, and then they kind of engaged with the analysts, like, do you like this? And they're like, yeah, that's going to save me a lot of time. And they're like, what else do you do? And we do this. And they sort of went away and worked at the weekend and came back again. And at one point they were like, can we just sort of do this? And I was like, yeah, because it is helpful. And they started at the end. And what was happening in parallel was something that started at the beginning, which was, okay, all the data's everywhere. How do we get it all into one place? And what technology is that going to be? And what ETL tools are we going to use? And how do we homogenize and standardize them? And is it one data set, or is it three data sets, or is it 10 data sets? And how would we structure those? And da 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 da. Big, heavy lifting, multi-year, multi-million dollar transformation program. And then down here, you've got like a couple of people spending a bit of their time delivering a tremendous amount of value because they started at the user and with the use case and building really strong empathy and understanding for what they were doing and what they needed to do, and then applied their, you know, their specialist skills in how can I help that person do that better. And I think if there's one thing that I think data products and data product management and certainly the chief data officer in hopefully overseeing a lot of that can be really transformative, is let's kind of start at the end. Like let's start with the use case. Let's start with the users. Let's do the bare minimum that we need to do to prove or disprove that hypothesis. To the point earlier, like a startup, I've got this great idea. Cool. Don't build it. Go and talk to some people and they'll tell you why you're wrong. And then give them something and then they'll show you why you're wrong. And then you can kind of go from there, just eating, you know, more and more and more humble pie until you've got something that's actually kind of helpful. And if you kind of start there, I think we'd end up in a much better place. But unfortunately, I think a lot of the conversations still start with perfection. I need to get all of my data into one place. I need the quality to be perfect. I need to monitor every single change or that will have a problem. I need full and complete governance over absolutely everything here. And it's like the scope of this is so enormous like you're never going to get to that end bit. Or by the time you get there, you've run out of steam, you've run out of money, you've moved to a different role, half your team have moved to a different role or a different career even, because it's been going on for so long. And it's just so heavy. And I think if we just started at the end, we'd find that the thing that we actually built to manufacture for a given use case would be quite different. I was doing I was hosting a webcast recently with two data product managers, and one of them, there's a brilliant quote, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something like, you don't need to go from 0 to 100. You just need to go from 0 to 1. But your customer just needs to have something that's better than what they currently have. It doesn't have to be perfection. And I think as data people, we have this, you know, we're a bit hardwired to want to really rigorously kind of get things to a level where they're like scientifically perfect. And I think in data, that's like a real challenge. And I think it's just a utopian vision that the reality is like you never manage to achieve it anyway.
Yeah. I'd agree with that. I mean, you know, the amount of conversations that you hear, you know, start with the business strategy, the use relevant use cases, build something for that, prove value quickly, that'll unlock more time, more funds, more yada, yada, yada. But unfortunately, as you said, it's been the flip reverse where it's like, right. Platform, go.
Yeah. Platform, all the data, perfect quality. Yeah, it's like see you in 20 years.
Yeah. Then 3 years later, the CEO's like, okay, we spent a lot of money and what are we getting from this? And it's like, oh, well, nothing yet because we've not actually tried to use it. It's like, well, you know, no wonder we end up in having these debates. I'm really conscious of time, Anthony. I guess what I'd love you to do, if you could, is just maybe talk through kind of an example that you've got or a, you know, a case study, because we always like to try and get to some real life examples where something has worked. Have you got anything that you can kind of talk through quickly, you know, problem, solution, results?
No. I think we, let me pick one of our publicly referenceable customers. I guess to illustrate some of these themes, let me choose Moody's. So Moody's Analytics, one of our customers, that's the data business side of Moody's, which is a large credit rating agency. And that business has been going really well, like really healthily for a really long time. So just sort of using that to illustrate some of the things we've been discussing, they do data product management and they've been doing data product management for decades and they've been doing it very, very successfully in a commercial way. So that's great. For them, they adopted us as their sort of front end to their customer experience around their data products. And where they really used it to best effect was it in providing each of their customers with self-service capabilities to distribute the data in the data products to any environment using any mechanism, you know, have it scheduled, have it event-driven, have it as a one-off, and being able to change the format on the fly. And their customers are now able to completely self-service that journey. So for them, that was like it was a cost saving because they had like a bunch of people sort of doing that work manually. And those people better spent doing kind of more value add activities. It was also a better customer experience. So if they want to change, they can just change it. If they now want it in an S3 bucket as opposed to via SFTP, they can just change it. They can run two in parallel until they're ready to migrate. Like they can do all of this good stuff. But I think that's also a classic example of instead of saying to everybody, okay, we can do it via SFTP. They were like, well, that's not what we want. Like our customers are moving to the cloud. Like they're moving and using our data in cloud databases, like and object stores. We want to give them choice and we want to give them flexibility and we want to give them a great experience that is, you know, commensurate with what you'd expect to receive in something as technological as data, which for some reason always seems to be the poor cousin, which is very odd. So effectively, they give that flexibility, they give that consumer choice, and that's good for the producers, it's good for the consumers, and it drives really clear, meaningful business value. So hopefully that kind of illustrates some of the things that we've kind of been talking about. And I think one interesting thing with that as well is, you know, that was a platform that was sort of you know, bought by Moody's, and then they branded it. It's called the Data Hub, and managed in that way. But they took that to the product teams, and the product teams decided whether or not they wanted to offer that choice to the consumers of their products. You know, and one by one, it kind of went like that. And what we're starting to see now, which is really interesting, it's been going on for a little while, is internally, those product teams are using the platform to collaborate and interact with each other to create kind of new data products that meet customer needs. But they can do it very easily within the platform. So we have like Workbench and Sandbox environments kind of built in. And it's a really easy way to kind of provision access, collaborate directly, and then create something new and immediately expose that to customers and take that to market and get that validation that it meets a use case and the specifications right. So we're starting to see these other use cases kind of emerge as well, which is really exciting.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, look, we could talk forever and a day about all this stuff, I'm sure, but conscious of time. So, thank you very much for coming on the show and giving us your time, Anthony. It's been an absolute pleasure. And looking forward to seeing how the rest of your journey with Harbour unfolds.
Thank you. And likewise, and I'm glad we finally managed to make it happen.
That's it for this episode of Driven by Data, the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back next week speaking with another thought leader from the world of data and analytics. Until then, please follow Orbition Group on social media if you've not already done so, where you'll be able to subscribe and therefore be made aware of the podcasts as they arrive. And please share, like, and leave reviews so that more people from our industry get to hear and benefit from these two. If you've got any questions or you want to suggest ideas for topics or potential guests, then please feel free to reach out to me. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week.